Welcome back to the Business Leaders of America podcast, where business leaders come to share their advice and journeys to success with existing and emerging leaders of America. Join us as we delve into the minds of these accomplished individuals, uncovering the strategies and insights that have propelled them to the top. Whether you're an established leader or an emerging force in the business world, this podcast is your go-to source for the knowledge and inspiration needed to navigate the dynamic landscape of American business. Now, here's your host, Dylan Bloyd.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Business Leaders of America podcast. Today, we're privileged to host Dr. Don Kapner, the accomplished Dean of Brad D. Smith Schools of Business at Marshall University. Don brings over two decades of expertise, from co-founding the iconic basketball apparel brand Above the Rim to his role as a strategy consultant at Chang Industrial. In this episode, we'll uncover the inspirations behind ATR, explore Don's diverse leadership journey, and gain insights into the dynamic landscape of business education. Join us for a captivating conversation of innovation, cross-cultural strategy, and the evolving role of leaders in shaping the future. Dr. Kapner, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Dylan.
All right, so if you could please go a little bit further on your background and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. Well, again, it's a privilege, and it's great to be able to speak with you today. And I look back over my career, and one of the key things that I think shaped my philosophy or leadership style is the leaders I had in my life. And some of them were not worth following, and I learned a lot from those. And at the same time, I also had some great leaders that I'll always be grateful for, because, you know, we do stand on the shoulders of people before us. Mm-hmm. So I spent my first 11 years in advertising and marketing roles, some on the agency side, and also in a chief marketing officer roles. And in that perspective, from a CMO's perspective, you're always under the gun. Mm-hmm. To produce revenue. So most companies now have a chief revenue officer. A lot of times it's the same thing, and you know, you're only as good as your last season. Mm-hmm. And so I'm used to and have the wrinkles to demonstrate, you know, lots of seasons where I had to, you know, make sure that we produced. And so what did I do during that early part of my career? I made media investments for clients and created promotional and brand messages, planned brand building activities, and experimented with new creative and media vehicles. And, you know, as tech evolved, mm-hmm. it was a very fast moving industry and very fascinating as the internet became central, right. You know, how we communicate and how we learn about brands. And so it's really evolved. And you know, the funnel that we always talk about for revenue, where all kinds of prospects get thrown in the funnel, and then a few trickle out as customers. Google tried to kind of turn that around by having sponsored search, mm-hmm. And inventing that. And then, you know, people who wanted to fly to Bermuda rose their hand, you know, in search. They said, oh, trip to Bermuda. And we thought that would flip the funnel, but yeah. We still got a funnel.
Really?
I love digital media and everything, but, you know, things go full circle. And mm-hmm. and so I learned a little there, and, you know, love to share some stories. Back then, I worked with athletic shoe brand managers and learned a lot before we actually launched Above the Rim. But I, of course, was the chief marketing officer and executive vice president, co-founder, mm-hmm. Along with my brother, Robert Kapner. Gotcha. And so, you know, we had worked with shoe manufacturers before. I worked a lot with franchise owners, healthcare marketers, packaged goods mm-hmm. companies, even fast food, co-ops, software, search and software marketers. And of course, closely, I hired and worked with art directors, graphic designers, copywriters,
right,
and lots of brand managers. So that's a little bit about my way back background. Today, people might call me a higher education executive, but also with Chang Industrial, I'm the strategist for them, and their work is with their clients, helping to find ROI commercialization paths for new technology, automation, autonomous systems. And a lot of times that's reworking a factory that needs updating and modernizing, but other times it's completely new systems. And so it's so exciting, and they have some, you know, wonderful clients, and I'm so privileged and grateful to be able to, you know, practice what I preach in the classroom, because as Dean of Marshall University, we have approximately 1,500 business students in a school that's just over 10,000 students in Huntington, West Virginia. So we're in Appalachia. And as you know, and that's an area of the country that has struggled economically in the past. And so it's so important to have a higher ed engine as a catalyst to help people who are either underemployed or have, you know, that desire to have a better life. And that's what gets me up every day and whistling to work, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, well, I can't wait to get into more about how you juggle all of that at once, especially right now. But before we do get into that, I'm a huge sports guy. So I do have to ask, what inspired the founding of Above the Rim? I'm very familiar with the brand. And what niche did you see in the market that led to its creation as the first basketball apparel brand?
So I don't know how often this story has been told, and it's my perspective. My brother's also, you could find, I think, on either Amazon, or there's a very, very short synopsis from his perspective, but I'll give you a 5-minute version of my perspective as the chief marketing architect. And he was the sales vision and had a lot of the design vision for Above the Rim. And so we played our roles and stayed in our lanes a lot. But I'll tell you this, working with family is never easy, but it can work. And we were together. We had a small advertising agency in San Diego. And that agency, we had about 14, 15 employees at the time, very, very small. We had several local accounts, and we missed working in sports. And you can relate to this, being a big sports fan.
Yes.
My brother Robert was known when he was younger as Bobby Capener, and he was the point guard for BYU's basketball program after Danny Ainge left.
Nice.
And so he was known, and also all Western Athletic Conference performer. And so he had that basketball heritage. I played at the University of San Diego and didn't quite have as much success in college, but my dig on my brother was that we were the CIF, my high school, Torrey Pines, was the CIF Southern Section champion
when I
was a senior.
Awesome.
And so I had a little basketball heritage myself.
Yeah.
And together, we missed being associated with the game. And we would go out and play in 3-on-3 tournaments and do a lot of things. And of course, that was quite a few years ago. And I was in my 20s and you know, even early 30s and still had some game. And so the opportunity for us was to get back associated with basketball. And the way that it came about was we were doing the advertising and marketing for Ocean Pacific, OP, you might have heard of, the company, a surf company. Anyway, OP at the time, it wasn't what it is now. And actually the style, believe it or not, were these short corduroy shorts. Now, this is in the late 80s, okay? You got to go way back into the retro to see some of this stuff. But, you know, the surf t-shirts and shirts, you know, sort of like Aloha shirts were already popular at the time. And so we did outdoor advertising, like in the outdoor billboards that you'd see on Interstate 5 between Los Angeles and San Diego. Okay. And in addition to that, print in Outside Magazine and or similar to, you know, those kinds of publications. And being in that business associated with apparel, we brought the idea of Above the Rim to Ocean Pacific and their president at the time and said, we got a great idea for a whole new brand line for you. So we didn't pitch it as our business.
Okay.
We pitched it as an idea for OP. They turned it down. But after the meeting, the production guy that was in the meeting, a senior guy, came to us. He called us up and said, hey, listen, I know some freelance people who could help you do this yourself.
Nice.
And we had shown, you know, instead of those corduroy shorts, we'd shown sort of an urban influence, long shorts and, you know, sweats and things. This is before Adidas sweats were a big deal.
Right.
And a lot of branded like basketballs and hard goods, like the actual have your own backyard basketball stand and hoop.
Right.
So those kinds of things that were branded Above the Rim. And of course, some of the famous things basketball players say, both to each other. And those sayings became iconic as part of the Above the Rim brand. A lot of those are actually came straight from my brother.
Really?
Bobby. Yeah. Oh,
that
and
is cool.
Most of those ideas and most of the actual screen prints that were done for Above the Rim. But fast forward a year after we launched, we were at a large sports show and we just had really one client. And this particular client was on the West Coast, mostly coastal properties. And even with just one client, we could hardly ship them because even with help with production, we were doing everything in the US and we were struggling just to satisfy 9 stores. And Athletic Express, Foot Locker's, one of their properties came to us and said, we want to do a 100 store test. Well, as an entrepreneur, you'd go, oh my gosh, that's my dream shot, baby.
Right.
But the flip side of that is, how are we going to deliver?
Yeah, how are we going to do
and
this?
We thought, you know, we can't mess this up.
Mm-hmm.
And this was even before we shrink wrapped everything and put the SKU, you know, digital stuff on. This was pre some of that.
Right.
And we had this little warehouse we'd use and we'd work from 8 to 5 on the advertising agency business. And then at night, we'd go over to the warehouse and pack these shipments.
Jeez.
And we do all of our advertising marketing within the agency. And just, we were one of the original sports brands that advertised on ESPN when it was new.
That is so cool.
And so all of this, and we were the first national sponsor that we know of Gus Macker 3-on-3. And they put Above the Rim on every one of the standards, the hoops, and all the Gus Macker official guys and the staff wore Above the Rim. And we sold product at those events. And of course, back then, you got to remember, people didn't have a website. So that was our way of selling direct, like a website manufacturer. Like if you had your own t-shirt company, you would sell through retailers, but you have to sell at wholesale so they can have a markup.
Right.
So it's worthwhile. A lot of times it's 100%. Well, you didn't have any outlet to sell direct because you didn't have a website.
Yeah.
So our ability was kind of, think of being a microbrewer. We could sell brew at the event.
Yes.
At full retail. Okay.
Yeah.
And so that was a way we financially made it the first year. Then finally, you know, sales did increase to about a clip of close to $10 million in annualized sales until Reebok made us an offer that we couldn't refuse.
Right.
And it became an international brand for Reebok.
Right. Oh, that is an incredible story. I could sit here for hours probably and listen to stories about that.
It was an amazing time, and I'm glad it brings back some both trying memories, but at the same time, you know, I used to have surfer hair before, you know, and look what happened after all that stress, not meeting those, every one of those orders. You know, we did do a really, we had a great group of an initial launch team, and our go-to-market strategy was, you know, something that I'm very proud of, given that we didn't have a playbook and there wasn't a non-shoe branded, you know, sport like that, that could make it on their own and right. as a national player. So I'm proud of what happened and how we evolved the brand, but it was there were some late nights and very, very difficult times right. in that process.
Yeah, everyone else just sees the finished product, right?
Exactly.
So yeah. I mean, that is really, really cool. Did you stick around with them for a little while after the sale, after the acquisition?
Well, we did. We had about a year after. I was still in an official marketing role for okay. after it was purchased and a kind of like a chief marketing officer kind of role. Mm-hmm. But quickly thereafter, you know, shoes, the above the rim shoes became more important than the apparel. And so, you know, they had a whole product design team, but my brother went to Stoughton, Massachusetts, worked directly for Reebok for several years and oh, wow. kind of helped as their first kind of director of basketball mm-hmm. and really helped shape the initial years of the brand, including he was responsible or at least partially responsible for signing Shaq and Sean nice. Kemp and yes. all the original Dominique Wilkins,
yeah,
all the original above the rim Flyers, as yeah. you probably know, it's lore for you. It was before you were born, but those were some of the original endorsees.
Yeah, yeah, definitely familiar. Yeah, even Horace Grant as well, I believe, right?
Yes, yes, yeah. exactly. Oh yeah, yeah, you know your stuff well.
Oh yeah, wow, for sure. No, that is really, really cool. So after you left marketing with them, did you, yes. is that when you kind of took on the education route?
Well, it did take me a few years. I went back and I worked for a company called Frankel in Chicago, which was the largest or one of the largest promotion agencies. And they had the Visa business. They had United Airlines. They had McDonald's. They had all these large accounts. I worked in downtown Chicago for them and headed the Visa business up. And eventually they moved me out to San Francisco to be close to the client, opened up an office there. And I operated as the general manager during that tenure and worked with Eddie Bauer and several other clients on the West Coast mm-hmm. for Frankel. But then Frankel was bought by Leo Burnett. And, you know, there was consolidation. And so eventually I was essentially working for Leo Burnett. But I was a couple of really bright guys from Harvard and Stanford started up a company called NetCentives. And NetCentives was the whole focus was a digitized. They were kind of the first SaaS company. You know, software, yeah. I mean, using a real digital asset.
Yeah.
And the digital asset was airline miles. And so the concept was they went to all the major airlines, including American, Delta, United, mm-hmm. Lufthansa, Japan Airlines. I could go on, all the international. Yeah. and they bought their, in bulk, their miles for resale online as an incentive. And then they went to the online retailers and said, hey, buy these for X cents a dollar, you know, from us. And then you can then provide 1,000 miles of any airline of your choice when you buy a book or a CD or. So we pitched the Amazons of the world and the folks that were out there. And the product pretty much was a complete failure because people weren't ready to buy online yet.
Right.
I mean, I think they love the idea of the incentive of miles. And it was even before the airline mileage cards were that popular. But I was recruited because I worked on the introduction of the mileage cards with Visa.
Okay.
And so the long and short of this is the company did a huge pivot. And that pivot was to sell miles as an HR, as a human resource incentive to sign on. Mm-hmm. For engineers, for anyone they were trying to recruit. And these were big awards.
Yeah.
Get 1 million, get 2 million miles for joining Netscape.
Wow.
As an engineer. And so they bought, literally it saved the company. They bought the hundreds of millions of miles. And it was a long list of companies that did it. And they weren't tech companies either, just tech. I mean, mm-hmm. a lot of tech, because we were San Francisco based, but We sold these all over to lots of mainline companies, and it saved the company. And a company went public via NASDAQ in October 1999. And after initially going out, I think at like $16 a share, it shot up to $98 a share.
Nice.
But unfortunately for the chief marketing officer, I'm not living on an island or sipping, you know, drinks on a beach, because by the time I could sell, the internet bubble, famous bubble of 2000 and 2001 had kicked in. And the company also, the real death nail was the IRS started taxing those awards. And once you added that cost onto it, it just became not attainable for companies to provide those, and, you know, at the high value that we were able to deliver without the IRS taxing it. So that's another story, another day. That led me, after that experience, led me into academia, because I always loved working with students. And the short story was, I was teaching at San Diego State as a part-time instructor when I launched, after I launched Above the Rim. And we got a lot of our best talent were interns that hired were my former students. I'd only teach one class a term, and taught advertising and campaigns and, you know, marketing there. And so it was a great way for talent acquisition for me. And so I did it for 3 or 4 years, but I always said if I could ever afford, I couldn't believe how little, especially faculty with, if you hadn't earned a PhD and didn't have tenure, how little they got paid. And so I thought, if I could ever afford to do this, or maybe I'd go back and get my PhD and do this full time. I love developing. What an impact I might be able to have if I could do this full time and help hundreds, if not thousands, of students develop, get their first jobs, make an impact in their careers, get promotions. The kinds of stuff that really motivated me and that I loved was something that I dreamed about doing. And it wasn't until after that NetCentives experience and, you know, a little bit of cash from the sale of NetCentives that I had sort of a runway to first, you know, get into academia, earn my PhD, and launch my academic career.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, look at you now. I'm sure you have impacted tons and tons of lives, because, I mean, you served as the dean of Jacksonville University and Utah Valley, right? University. So what unique aspects or characteristics do you find at Marshall that set it apart from those previous roles now that you're at Marshall? And are they similar? Because I know you were a different role at Utah Valley, right?
Yes. Every school is different in terms of their student profile. And, you know, it reflects the culture of that region. So if I said to you, hey, how's Nevada Reno different than UNLV? You would be able to tell me.
Yes.
Okay. Because you have friends who
much
went
better.
There.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. No, you'd be able to tell me like the vibe. Okay.
Right. Yes.
That, but on top of that, too, is really the school's faculty and their industry around the school, or it shapes the school a lot of ways. So you think the school shapes the community. It really, the schools are a reflection, and their talent generation is a reflection of the needs of the business community when they're working well. So I knew that, loved staying, you know, always loved shop talk and being with, rubbing elbows with folks. And that's led me to being a former student of mine. Matt Chang started Chang Industrial.
Oh, wow.
And one of the reasons I'm working with him is because I love being associated with decision makers today and being in the game.
Right.
I mean, I just love that. And so I wanted to try and replicate that as best I could in every one of the experiences. So each one reflected the business community. In Jacksonville was trying to kind of shed a reputation of being kind of a stodgy former insurance town, a little bit Southern and not progressive.
Okay.
And they were trying to shed that and be more kind of, I'll call it hip, and have an entrepreneurial vibe.
Right.
like you hear about Tampa today. Mm-hmm. Well, Jacksonville was trying to do that, and they had a few Fortune 500 companies. And the speaking of Nevada, Bill Foley, who started the Golden Knights in the hockey club in Las Vegas, was the CEO of Fidelity National, FIS, and back then it was lenders, their Black Knight Financial. And those companies, along with CSX, the railroad, kind of shaped Jacksonville, but it was kind of considered stodgy and not cool to, you know, either start up there or locate your company there. And several people, I, you know, was one of the hopefully key players to try and help change that, and worked with the Carlton Robinson and several my counterparts at University of North Florida, some of my colleagues at Jacksonville University, including the founder of the school, Fran Kinney, who was the first woman president of a major university. And so she, and then her bringing the Davis family in, they helped really help reshape Jacksonville, brought the Mayo Clinic there. A lot of cool stuff happened in Jacksonville. Now Jacksonville is not considered stodgy. It's considered like up and coming. I mean, it's a really great place. I left in 2019, didn't see the huge spike that happened post COVID. But at Utah Valley, it was all around software as a service, because the big company out there that made it big is the guy who, you're a sports fan, who bought the Jazz. He was the founder of Qualtrics. So this software as a service and all these companies, Podium, let's see, there's a whole bunch of them, Weave, there's MX, all these in Silicon Slopes, they call it. And that shaped the Utah Valley area because it was south of Salt Lake City. So it was a different vibe, right? And so, and you know, and the students, the culture was very different. A lot of young people got married really early. They were, you know, religious, and and it was a totally different vibe, right?
In Florida.
And so that was fun. I was the number two guy in the business school and the head of all the graduate programs in the business school. And then I went to be the an associate provost in the provost office, which is above the deans. And then, I was a dean also of professional studies, continuing education there, also working with the business school directly. So love that time period. Learned a lot about certificates and how important, you know, hey, education isn't just about traditional bachelor's, master's, doctorate at all. It's, you know, badges are everything now. Badges are a big deal to have a credential that maybe that, you know, is a shorter term credential, but it shows you know some stuff. And if it's from a legitimate or a strong provider, employers value those.
Right.
And I learned so much during that time period. So I came here I started in the summer of 23 with the idea that we had, hey, a president who had been CEO of Intuit and done all of this stuff in Silicon Valley. And then he had been originally, he was a Marshall grad and been originally from here, came back, wanted to take this Appalachian region and reinvigorate it. And brand new building now. We have a business building. We have resources that to really invigorate this region, which can use some, there's a lot of unemployment. I mean, there's a lot of, there's a higher unemployment rate here than other parts of the country, but more importantly, there's more underemployed people.
Wow.
Who with a little help and education and continuing ed and, and a little education spike and knowledge, intellectual curiosity, could get that promotion and, you know, get out of that rut of being always feeling like, hey, I really deserve a better job or I'm smart enough to do this, but I just haven't gotten the break yet. And so having the chance to reach a lot of non-traditional students, in addition to, you know, a traditional kind of student that comes here, was super attractive. The provost here, which is the second in charge, Avi Murkaji, I knew him for 10 years. I respected him. I always knew that I would love to work for him someday, that I could learn a lot from him. The fact that he came here, he wasn't from here.
Yeah.
And that, you know, they had, I mean, Brad Smith's on the Amazon board.
Mm-hmm.
Not very many people could say that,
No.
right?
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And so, you know, to have all these wonderful, and they recruited several other really, I think, strong deans of national prominence. So we've got a great team here that helped attract me here. And now, you know, I love the faculty that's here. We have a strong health informatics program. We have some really great marketing and information services, kind of analytics kind of folks.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got a sports marketing, sports management, I mean, program too. And so, but we have several strong programs, and it's on the heels of the fact that I sort of rise and fall on the shoulders of people, as I said, who were here before and helped shape this school. And of course, the school has a national name for the football team that died in the plane crash. Right. Probably heard of the We Are Marshall.
Yes.
You know, and Matthew McConaughey starred in a Hollywood made film about that. And this is We Are Marshall.
Yeah,
we are
exactly.
That Marshall.
Now, it sounds like an incredible team, some amazing programs. So maybe a little later in this conversation, we'll figure out how anybody who's listening, any of the listeners, can get a little more information on that and, you know, potentially further their education at Marshall. So thank you for that. You know, I like hearing about what you said about shaping the universities. I always love to ask leaders how their previous positions have shaped them, especially in like their leadership journeys, you know. So how has your leadership approach evolved over the years and that ultimately led you to Marshall?
Well, of course, I learned from my mistakes, and I've made lots of mistakes, including it above the rim. I mean, you know, a lot of people will say, hey, you folks, you know, sold right as you were going up. And you know, why did you do that? And what, you know, what led to that? And I made lots of mistakes in my career. And I think that the sum total of that is an education at the School of Hard Knocks, and in addition to formal education. And so I think the best combination for leaders are a combination of that, I'll call it experience, lots of different roles, being challenged by people who are smarter than you, and being willing to be in a room with, you know, and go into company with people who are going to challenge you all the time. So my management and leadership philosophy is shaped in a lot of ways by all those experiences, and both my formal and my, I call it on the job kind of training. And and a lot of that is, you know, trial and error and making mistakes. Marketing, I mean, we classic marketing idea is to come up with two different offers and put those out there and see which one actually performs better in the marketplace. A/B testing, it used to be called. Now, you know, you do it online, you do it with Qualtrics, you do it with all kinds of different vehicles to test, and, you know, sprint cycles. A lot of people can call it a lot of different things, but I grew up in that classic world at a world-class firm, Frankel, that was doing that before it was cool. And before it was how Eric Ries and his startup Bible, you know, said, hey, you gotta have trial and error for everything you do. And a customer has to demand this and be willing to pay for this before you add a bell and whistle to, you know, a minimum viable product. Well, that shaped me. Also, Simon Sinek's Start With Why is very influential. I mean, I read that after a lot of my leadership experiences, but the idea of being inspirational versus manipulative resonates with me. And so I don't believe long-term you can manipulate somebody, because there's not enough money in the world to you know, continually manipulate if you can't inspire anyone. And so my focus has been always to inspire people to be intellectually curious, but intellectually curious about something that could drive their economic engine. It can't just be out of something that they love, because a lot of times, you know, you could love badminton, but there's probably not going to be a lot of money in your badminton business unless you turn it into something like pickleball.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's an example. I'm trying to, you know,
of course.
So the point that I'm trying to make is that inspirational leadership really drives me. And my goal is that the people that I work with and mentor do better than me and make smarter decisions than I make. And then I try and bring people in as faculty members here at Marshall, as staff members that are brighter and more capable than me, or at least will challenge me to be the best version of myself.
Gotcha. Do you feel like a lot of the people that you bring in are similar to you, or is there a lot of training that goes involved in that when you're bringing faculty members in?
You know, one of the things that's often thought in the academic model is that the dean hires the faculty.
Yeah.
And it's really a misnomer, because the dean is there to really just help find resources and make the environment a place that great faculty members want to do research, to do great teaching, to do, you know, serve students and help students succeed. And that comes really in the departments themselves. They are the hiring managers. They are the hiring committees, and department chairs are usually the I'll call it the chair of the hiring committee.
Gotcha. Oh, okay.
So yes, is there veto power? Yes. Do I want to try and shape what the goals are and what the priorities are that then lend themselves to what the job postings are or the programs we're focusing on? I'd like to think I have some influence in that. And
gotcha.
I have a passion for international because it shaped my life. I lived in Japan. I learned how to speak fluent Japanese. I've kept that up. And being the different person in the room shapes you forever, because, you know, you have to fit into that culture, or you at least have to understand it to flourish in that culture. And so it really shaped my life at an early age, at 19, 20 years old, being in a place where a lot of people, almost everyone, didn't speak fluent English, if not very few people even spoke English. And unless I was in Tokyo with all international people, I, you know, it was incumbent on me to learn their culture, learn their language, learn about their food and customs. And, you know, part of what's me is the fact that I had that experience and I've kept up with it. I've been going to Japan for 40 years. Almost every year, if not more often than once. And some of my best friends in the world live there.
Right.
And I, although I don't live there anymore, the fact that I've learned about a different culture and can speak a different language and understand where other people are coming from has opened my eyes and my mind to so many new possibilities. So I try to hire people who think differently as a result. And again, who challenge me to think in ways that I haven't thought about before. And at the same time, of course, I want to see grit, fortitude, and some important aspects that I think have been the hallmark of people who have succeeded in the organizations that I've led.
Right. Yeah. My favorite subject at the University of Nevada, Reno, when I was going to the College of Business, was international business management. You know, I enjoyed learning about the cultural differences in the workplace. I'm sure you encounter those at Chang Industrial, right?
Yes. Yes.
Can you provide an overview of the role as a strategy consultant at Chang Industrial? And how do you address cross-cultural challenges within the organization and ensure effective communication and collaboration?
I'm happy to do that. And as dean at Marshall, also, we have international partners. Like in Asia, we have several in Japan. We have several in South Korea, in China, in India, and Thailand. So I also get that opportunity, whether it's joint programs, whether it's faculty exchanges, whether it's recruitment of students that graduate from an undergrad program there, come to us as graduate students.
Wow.
All that international exchange happens. At Chang Industrial, they have international companies. And those international companies, whether they're operating in Asia or operating in Europe or South America, the Middle East, the focus, of course, is, you know, factory automation is different potentially depending on the culture in different places, and the way different cultures approach work can be different. So a win in Europe may not necessarily be a huge win in South America if in fact it deplays it, it the economics are different and the pain points are different. And as a result, doing what I do always has to be in context, and it always has to be based on, you know, what's keeping the leaders of those companies who are clients of Chang Industrial up at night, or what dreams do they have that will transform their business? The folks who are Matt Chang and Kate McFoos and Ross Bernard, the original founders, they did great things for lots of, you know, companies that now are household names, and Frito-Lay, for Coca-Cola, for Starbucks. And they worked in prior roles for when they worked at Pulse and when they worked prior to that at Haskell, and did all kinds of incredible things. Well, they brought all that knowledge, that know-how to Chang Industrial, now Chang, which it's also another doing, they do business as Chang Robotics. And the whole idea is, of course, how automation can help them from a, I'll call it a cost standpoint, but also just to retain the employees that they have and to keep them growing. So it's that differs across the world. So to answer your question, what a huge win in research and development and innovation in the Middle East isn't necessarily the same as in Northeast Asia. And so that knowledge that I have, I apply that directly. Also getting the investment and mapping out the commercialization path or the go-to-market plan for some of this new technology or even a new product line is something that is valued by Chang Industrial's clients. And I provide that. And so I'm one of the only non-mechanical or packaging engineers or civil engineers. You know, I'm with all these guys from Georgia Tech and all these great universities, but they're engineers.
Yes.
And I'm working on the commercialization and business side. And so it's just amazing every week to be around these folks who are doing these cool things.
Right. Like I said earlier, I don't know how you're juggling it all. That is incredible. To be the dean at Marshall, the business dean at Marshall, to be doing what you're doing with Chang Industrial is inspiring.
Well, one quick thing is, I told you what a great provost we have here. Mm-hmm. And when I came here, I said, you know, by letting me be involved, and it's, you know, what 20 hours a week, I mean, 20 hours a month.
Yeah.
I said to be involved is to keep me on the cutting edge of where students will get jobs now and in the future.
Yeah.
And to be connected with not just employers, but some of these clients that are really making the kinds of decisions that shape the business market in their respective industries. I mean, these are number one and number two players in all of their industries. Jeez. And to be able to have that and have those relationships and then leverage those relationships on behalf of the business school and for students is, I think, a strategic advantage for Marshall. And it's something that I leverage all the time on behalf of Marshall students.
Right. Yeah. Speaking of being on the cutting edge, what is your vision for the future of business education? And how do you see it evolving to meet the demands of a changing business landscape with everything changing, you know, at a rapid pace?
So I mentioned the fact that continuous learning involves always being intellectually curious around things where there's an economic opportunity and an opportunity to improve yourself and your economic situation. So a lot of things have to line up. It's kind of like a flywheel from Jim Collins' original Built to Last, but it's your own personal flywheel. What drives your economic engine personally? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what are you really good at? What's your genius? You know, what are you super great at or have an aptitude for. And you those need to line up also with an actual opportunity. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the marketplace where it needs to where the marketplace is now needs to line up with those other two parts of the what I call flywheel. So your personal focus should align with those in a way that then everything can click. Okay. And that only happens when you are intellectually curious. You're always pushing the limits. You're always trying to earn a new certificate, a badge, mm-hmm. learn about things, be active on LinkedIn and comment. And you could probably tell that I'm pretty active yeah. myself and I'm not looking for a job.
Right.
So, I'm super active because I love it. And mm-hmm. I love being knowledgeable about new things and how the economy, you know, it's the ebb and flow and shape is changing.
Yeah.
And there's so many new opportunities that are going to be part of the AI world.
Mm-hmm.
So to come full circle, I encourage that intellectual curiosity. I encourage you and all of your listeners to think about ways in which they can combine their genius or their skills, their talents. Okay. Think of the biblical parable of the talents, you know, mm-hmm. taking those talents and multiplying those
right.
in ways that not only help you, but help others because it'll come back to you. Mm-hmm. I really believe that. So it's multiplying your talents, taking those geniuses and those talents and then at the same time, looking for the intersection where the economic opportunities are. And all these should fuel each other. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, naturally, you're going to have to keep learning in traditional and untraditional ways. So if you don't have a master's degree, find an area where you can work on that. You don't need to do it in a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can, but you don't need to do it in a year. You can start with a certificate and go there. A lot of schools like ours are, you know, developing programs where you could come in with two or three courses, earn a certificate, but then when you want to do your master's credential, you're already three courses down.
Nice.
In a, you know, 10 course program. So those kinds of things exist all over. There's so many opportunities right now. I wish I was your age and I wish I was starting my career at this time when, you know, the next potential revolution with generative AI that's out there,
mm-hmm.
there's going to be an explosion, a metaphoric kind of mushroom of knowledge.
Yeah.
That's going to, and potentially all kinds of economic opportunities as millions of people get access to even a cell phone. And all of that, you know, Hayek, one of the most brilliant people there's ever been, said, and Joseph Sumpater, this is even better, said, you know, the most powerful thing in the world is an entrepreneur with specialized knowledge and the passion and drive to commercialize that.
Mm-hmm.
He predicted way back almost 100 years ago, it would shape the world, and his prophecy has come true, and it is coming right. true in front of our eyes.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. Thank you. Thank you for sharing all that. So you did talk a little bit about LinkedIn. How can listeners engage with you and get more information on pursuing an education at Marshall University, specifically Brad D. Smith Schools of Business?
Thanks for that question. Of course, I'd love to link with your listeners on LinkedIn. So we can share ideas. I'd be happy to try and address specific questions they might have either from this podcast or from other things they've been pursuing. Love interacting with folks. It's how I learn.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of it is, of course, there's some great traditional programs and certificate programs here at Marshall University. The Lewis College of Business and the Brad D. Smith Colleges of Business are here basically to be a catalyst for West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And our graduates are everywhere from the governor of the state to CEOs running major corporations in Appalachia and the new product manager, mm-hmm. okay, that just graduated or last year. So there are opportunities, of course, to join the network, to be part of the herd. And at the same time, there's opportunities, of course, to, from distance learning perspective, tapping into what we think is, you know, a great hands-on focused, really tangible, not so much focus on theory, but more focus on what are the implications of what we're learning to what you will be doing in your job. That's the focus here. We focus on the delta, which means the change between when we meet a student, where they are right then, to where they will be when they finish the course, mm-hmm. or even the entire program. If the delta is big, we succeeded. It didn't matter that they started lower or below someone else. If the delta was big, we feel we succeed. And so we measure ourselves on that delta. And that's why we teach students who are brilliant, and we teach students who have learning difficulties or challenges, or they just weren't motivated. Mm-hmm. And this is their second chance.
Right.
And this is a place for people with second chances. We're a second chance business school, and we're one that are proud that our delta is bigger than a lot of Ivy League schools.